back. It's time for the second part of It's All About Food here on January 21st, 2014. How are you doing? And as I mentioned before, send me an email at info@realmeals.org about anything. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you're thinking, especially when it has to do with food. Okay. Let's move on, because we have some very serious things to talk about. And I am going to do that with my next guest, who has written a pretty incredible book. Dr. Richard Openlander is a consultant, researcher, and author whose award-winning book, Comfortably Unaware, has been endorsed as a must-read by Ellen DeGeneres, Dr. Jane Goodall, and Neil Barnard, among many others. He is a much-sought-after lecturer on the topic of food choice and how it relates to sustainability, all within the framework of fresh perspectives and critical insights. He's been a keynote speaker for several conferences and festivals and has presented lectures and workshops at numerous universities and corporations. He also serves as an advisor to municipalities in the U.S. and to a number of World Hunger projects that are designing programs from his multidimensional model of sustainability. He has spent 40 years studying the effects of food choices have on our planet and on us. He started an organic vegan food production company, operates an animal rescue sanctuary, and is the founder and president of the nonprofit organization Inspire Awareness Now. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Openlander.
Well, hi, Karen. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I want to take just a moment to thank you for your work over the years in spreading
thank
awareness.
Thank you.
It's always encouraging.
You know, every time I talk to another incredible vegan that's doing great work, I keep thinking, maybe it's this food that's powering us to be able to do all the different things that we do. You've got an incredible little resume going on here. What don't you do?
Well, I haven't changed everybody in the world to eat the most healthy, peaceful food yet.
So. We have a lot of work to do, don't we?
We do.
Okay, you wrote this book, Food Choice and Sustainability. I imagine you spent many years on this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have actually. I mean, it's the precursor was my first book, Comfortably Unaware, as you know. But this one is sort of a compilation of everything, and I think more importantly, it's timed very, very properly, because it's, as you know also, that the word sustainability has been frequently misused, if not abused, and it rarely, if ever, positions food choice, and it never positions the choice of raising and eating and slaughtering animals in any sustainability projects or efforts that I'm aware of, and this is why I wrote the book, essentially.
You almost make it sound like the word sustainability is a bad word.
Well, it's a great word if it's defined correctly, and I guess that's the whole role of the book, is that we need to incorporate food choice, specifically the raising and eating of animals, into sustainability efforts, or then we will never reach true sustainability. Now, the devastations that's taking place right now as we speak is jeopardizing not just, you know, the animals or individual human health, it's jeopardizing our survival as a species. And if that seems a little dramatic, then that also becomes part of the problem, because we just don't want to hear about it, which is one of the reasons we're in trouble and why I wrote the book, because the story needs to be told, and it needs to be told through an unfiltered lens.
It is a dramatic story, and we all need to be doing something yesterday, and we're not. And the question is, are we going to be able to get this information out in time? You know, the earth will take care of herself.
Yes.
But whether we're on it is another question.
well, that is the question, isn't it? It's sort of the Gaia theory that's exploding on us, because, right, species have the tendency to adapt and make its own environment and integrated in somewhat of a symbiotic way, whether we're here or not. And I think that's the issue that we're confronted with. But until we understand the devastation first that's taking place, and then recognize that we have to do something about it, and then what we have to do about it, then it's also, there's a timeline issue. There's a series of disconnects here, and you sort of sum them up in the way you just stated that, because the final disconnect is actually
Game
it's extremely
over.
Important with yeah it's way
yeah.
as we're in overshoot mode right now. We're taking from and doing more to our planet than what it can sustain. It would almost take two Earths to sustain what we're currently taking from and doing to it, and most of that's because of our choice of foods.
Okay, this is an intense book. It's over 400 pages, small print. There's a lot of information in here, and it's a great reference and resource for anybody who wants to get all of this information out there. But let's start the way you start in the beginning. We'll touch on a couple of topics here in our short time together.
Sure.
And climate change. So this past weekend, we had a little article in the New York Times Sunday Review, Nicholas Kristof's column. I like to read his from time to time. I don't know if you read him, but he sounds like he's somebody that I think we can manipulate a little bit. It sounds like he's learning a little bit more than he wants to know about animal agriculture, but he doesn't talk about it in this column. He talks about how it seems like there's very little discussion about climate change in the media, and that 77% of humans seem to be more believing that aliens have visited the Earth versus 44% that believe that humans are causing climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some serious problems there. And nobody is talking about how food can make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. So you just hit on a number of different disconnects, haven't you? And that article, I think, actually, if you not only read through it very well, but also take a step back from it, it actually displays our ultimate disconnect, which is that the climate change is happening. I mean, all scientists will tell you that. There are a few people that don't believe it, but it is happening. But the most important aspect of that is that what we can do about it, the anthropogenic greenhouse gases, the human-induced greenhouse gases that are being created, will be somewhere between 30 minimally and 51% are caused or derived from livestock. And there have been at least four different researchers independent of each other that have quantified those and explained them and documented them. So the issue is that you're exactly right, we don't have nearly enough time to expound on all this, but I do in my book. But I can summarize by saying that each year our leading policymakers and governmental officials and nonprofit organizations and researchers meet in the climate change conferences supported by the United Nations, and agriculture, actually, the umbrella topic is postponed until next year, and it's postponed just about every year, and livestock is never, the raising or eating of animals and their contribution is never discussed. And yet, again, up to 51% of all greenhouse gases that we produce are caused by livestock, and that doesn't include our demand, the greenhouse gases, because of our demand to eat fish, you know, the refrigeration, fuel processing, transportation, et cetera. So it's a very large issue, and the larger issue is, I think, why? You know, why aren't the organizations mentioning that? And I have a lot of those type of answers and theories and perspectives in my book as well.
That's the big question. Why? Well, I'm very aware of the numbers you're mentioning. The 51% of human-induced greenhouse gases was put forth by Jeff Hanhang and Robert Goodlin, who unfortunately just passed away in December.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We miss you, Robert.
That's right.
And but there are some other people out there like Frank Mitlohner who debates against this and says that livestock can actually improve climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he's been hired by the USDA to work with them on this.
Well, Karen, yeah, okay, so a couple of things about that. One is also Alan Savory, you know, that's been on TED Talks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote a nice review of that that people can find online now. But basically, here's where we are. Livestock now occupy 45% of the entire land mass on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They're also the most destructive force for our rainforests, which are being destroyed in the Amazon area, at least up to 90% of all the loss of Amazon since 1970 has been due to livestock and crops to feed them. Well, the issue is this. The reason that it's so difficult for them to address this correctly or to suppress it or, you know, shove it under the rug a little bit is because of a couple reasons. One is that it's so culturally ingrained, they themselves most likely consume animal products. So how
mm-hmm.
we expect our leaders to change if they themselves are doing something that, you know, they can't change for themselves. Secondly is that they're afraid. They're very much afraid of losing their audience or their platform because 98% of the rest of the people in the world consume animal products. So they feel as if they're going to lose their platform, even if they were very much aware of all these stats and figures and took it seriously. So They're also very, very concerned about the powerful meat, dairy, and fishing industries, which control $1 to $2 trillion worth of goods and policies, and policies meaning subsidies, as well as their budget for marketing. So it's a very large scaled problem that we have on all those levels.
The thing about climate change that's especially scary, and we're going to talk about some of the other things in your book, is that it seems like once we're really into the significant warming of the Earth, there's no turning around.
Right. Well, what you're talking about are tipping points.
Yes.
Right. And it's very well established by the International Energy Agency and most of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They all agree that we only have a 3-year window of time from now,
mm-hmm.
actually, to drastically reduce them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the whole issue. And if you look at it carefully, the easiest thing we can do is just stop eating animals. If you're looking at how to change it in terms of, for instance, most of the money that's being devoted or set aside now by the United Nations is going to renewable energy, but it's projected by most experts to take at least 20 years and another $18 trillion to develop. And obviously, if we have a tipping point in 3 years, I mean, just do the math, and we don't have 20 years to wait, and we also don't have $18 trillion. So, you know, the easiest solution is just to do what is obvious and take away, reduce, or eliminate the 51% due to livestock.
It sounds so sweet and so simple.
well, yeah, it is.
So here's just one more climate question.
Sure.
And I don't know that you have the answer, but, you know, Earth has a long history. And we know through all kinds of evidence that the climate has changed dramatically every 100,000 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we know that the climate is really going to be affected by what we do? I mean, I know that we've seen more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but, you know, the Earth and nature is so powerful. How do we even think that we can have such a big impact?
Well, right. Well, so you're asking a very, very large scientific question, and I can answer part of that by saying that, yes, there are fluctuations. Anybody who's studied those will attest to that. I think the issue at hand, Karen, isn't so much that we are causing entirely the every single effect you see. I think the larger question, the overriding question here is that what effect do we have on greenhouse gases that are then contributing to climate change? It's sort of a intrinsically related in a linear pattern. Like, for instance, you look at almost all scientists involved and climatologists that are involved in anything to do with our history of our planet and climate will agree that we are going through a period of time where climate change is accelerating faster than any other time that we know of, certainly in our history. And they also agree that human-induced greenhouse gas emissions are heavily contributing to that. So therefore, we have a choice. I mean, we have a choice to just let it go and continue on, or we have a choice to reduce those things that we have the ability to reduce. I mean, we may not be able to reduce many of the other aspects of greenhouse gas emissions, for instance, non-anthropogenic methane production by various faults and things like that, but we mm-hmm. certainly can do something about our habits and our choices.
You know, we don't hear this enough, and the real problem are humans on the Earth. I mean, if we weren't here, I don't think we'd be seeing all of these
That's right.
problems.
Well, you know, another good example, I don't know if you're going to get onto this or move on to this topic right now, but I mean, just to give you an example, which I think it segues pretty nicely, is that our oceans are being destroyed, and our oceans are one of the moderators of mm-hmm. our climate, obviously. They're the ones that drive our climate. And our oceans right now are becoming more acidic and they're warmer, more acidic, and they have deoxygenation occurring faster than any other time that we've seen in the last 300 million years. And at that time, it took, I think most researchers felt that somewhere around 95% of all oceanic life became extinct. And it took 30 million years to recover.
Oh.
And most of the drivers for that warming and acidification can be directly related to the greenhouse gases that we're producing. So if 30 to 51% are being produced by our food choices on land, and then at the same time the oceans are becoming acidified by the carbon dioxide, and at the same time that's happening, we're completely depleting all the life by fishing and by the types of destructive methods that we're using by fishing. I mean, 85% of all fish have been depleted or overexploited. So if we're doing that, those are our choices, Karen. They're not something that just the world has changed and evolved. We're actually devolving, you know, because of our choices, if that's the right term. But, you know what I mean, we're going backwards, and it's seriously affecting the Earth in many, many ways. Those are just a couple. I mean, climate change and our oceans. But, I mean, we're also depleting our fresh water.
You talk a lot about a lot of things in this book, and the oceans and the fish and the extinction of a lot of species of fish.
Yeah.
And yet people are continually getting the message to eat more fish. And
yes.
Half of the fish today is farmed.
Right. Right, that's right. Well, there are a couple issues with that.
Big issues.
Yeah. One is, you're right, the USDA came out about 2 years ago, in 2012, suggesting that Americans double their intake of fish. And what that's going to do is actually going to just create more depletion and obviously more devastation because of the fishing methods, but also it's the targeted fish are being depleted. No matter whether they're titled sustainable or not, there's really no such thing as sustainable commercial fishing right now, regardless of whether MSC or, you know, the Marine Stewardship Council or anybody else puts a label on it. And there are many reasons for that I mm-hmm. expound on in my book, but also because of the devastating effects of, or the damages to various intertwining ecosystems that are actually infinite in quantity. And we haven't really, you know, there's no human that can calculate that equation of infinity in the oceans. We just go in and pluck things out and then hope that somehow they're going to recover, but they're not. And you mentioned other species. I mean, that's just in our oceans, but you know, it's been estimated that somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times the amount of species that are going extinct per year that we've had for the previous several thousands of years.
I know a lot of people are eating more fish because they're encouraged to, and there are many of my listeners that are very knowledgeable about the food system but still believe fish is an important food.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, people need to understand how we're getting fish today. You know, it's not, you know, a couple of rugged, ruddy fishermen in a boat and a line. It's obscene what's happening. And you mentioned the word infinity as if the ocean was infinite, and it's not.
That's right.
Can you talk about trawlers and the nightmare that's going on in our oceans?
Well, right. There are really a couple different ways that our oceans are being destroyed. And I mentioned one of them initially, which we can't, in any frank discussions about depletion of our oceans, really have to begin with land-based animal agriculture, which we just highlighted, but because that's what's causing some of the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing the devastation in the type of water that we have in our oceans. But in terms of life, yes, it's affecting our oceans and sea life in a number of ways. The first is, of course, the target fish. We go after massive amounts of target fish with various methods, from trawling, both bottom trawling, which many have heard about as being destructive, but there's also middle-level trawling, and there's also long-line fishing, which causes serious issues. There's purcine, which just scoops up every single living thing within a mile radius. Some long-line fishing methods extend a long line the length of between 30 and sometimes 100 miles behind a boat, and they catch every single thing that's even swimming near that.
I can't imagine it.
No, I mean, to give you an example, there's a swordfish fishery in Canada that was labeled sustainable just a year and a half ago by MSC, and yet for every 20,000 swordfish they catch and kill 100,000 sharks, and they also catch and kill about 1,000 to 2,000 loggerhead and leatherback turtles that are nearly extinct. And yet the fishery was labeled sustainable. And that's the way it is with most fisheries. You know, they just do so much damage to the target fish themselves, but also collateral damage of bycill, and then also destroying ecosystems that depend on that. For instance, krill. You know, we're taking krill at the rate of about 1.5 million tons per year from the Antarctic, and yet baleen whales such as blue right and fin and all the species of seals and many other sea life depend on that krill for their life. So, you know, and there are other ways, I guess, getting back to what you said there, we don't have nearly enough time to discuss all the human aspects, but there are so many more, and you know this, more beneficial ways to get more, so much healthier ways to derive health benefits from other food sources than from fish.
And then there's our government.
of course.
Which seems to, like, move slower than anything out there and is the last to discover what's important. We like to think that we have a safe food system, that we have a regulated food system that protects us and brings the best to us. And even these certifications that you were just mentioning that you go into great detail in your book, these different certifications by companies that tell us which fish we can eat and which we can't, and they're not even telling the truth.
Right.
How do people know what to do?
Well,
who do we
okay.
trust?
So let's separate out what you're asking. I mean, in sort of an overarching way, I can say that you're exactly right, that our government, much of this could be in the hands of the government, but you're asking policymakers that are stumbling over so many different things, and they're biased in so many different ways. So the most important, and by the way, our food bill still hasn't been established from 2012, and there's been so much time and effort and money tied into that, but they are really operating under the wrong pretense as well and under the wrong definitions. They're not defining sustainable well at all either, or healthy food, and that's something that I expound on quite a bit in the book as well. But to answer it a little bit better, I think the easiest thing to do is to just first of all start understanding more about the benefits of purely plant-based food. And I'm not talking about taking a few little baby steps here and there. I'm talking about, you know, for every bite of food that you eat that's plant-based, you're going to be saving lives, and you're going to be saving our planet's life. And you may end up eventually, I mean, in the most recent lectures I give, I sort of ask everybody to consider being superheroes or heroes with every single thing they eat, because that's exactly what we're doing. We're most likely, collectively, if we all do this, we're going to be saving our own species, let alone every other species on Earth. And so that's the first step, is understand that, and then look for those type of food items. And because no matter what the government says, if you understand that the basis of healthy eating really comes from healthy production, agricultural production, and what very, very finite and few resources we have to produce this with. For a burgeoning population of expected to be over 9 billion people by the year 2050. So as we go along, we're going to have to find the most resource efficient foods, what I call it, finding the most optimal relative sustainability. You know, the ones that you can produce with the least amount of resources that will affect our health in the most optimal way, and create the least amount of greenhouse gases or effect on climate change, and be the most compassionate. So we start looking at what food is that I can put in my mouth, that I can have grown, especially in a collective manner, globally, that fits that, then it has to be plant-based, because it's just extremely inefficient, not to mention not being compassionate or all these other, unhealthy for our own human health to eat these animal-based products. So I think that's the first step, no matter what the government is going to be telling you. You know, we have to start finding solutions on our own, and then eventually the government will have these tasks in front of them, either by a collective movement, or they'll be realizing where all of our fresh water is going and where all of our land's going and why our health care costs are so high in our country. It's going to hit sooner or later, and then they'll have to make changes.
You mentioned fresh water, and you talked more before about sustainability, and we have, let's just mention our aquifers for a moment. We have farmers all over the country and in other countries actually draining at alarming rates these aquifers that contain incredibly beautiful fresh water that was created in the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 15 million years ago. I mean, that's such a large problem. Now, I first want to point out that most people, in an argumentative mode, would say, well, the water's all constant on Earth, and that's true. Water as an entity is constant, but the consumptive form that it happens to be in is not. In fact, it's projected that in just 14 years, there'll be a 40% shortage in fresh water, and that's because of how it's being used right now. And about 29% of all fresh water withdrawals in the world go to livestock. And it's terribly inefficient, and it may require 100 to 400 times the amount of water to produce a pound of meat as it would for a pound of much higher nutritional value of plant-based foods. And you're right about the aquifers. Typically in the United States, I mean, there are quite a few, but a couple that come to mind are the Ogallala that provide water, fresh water, as you said, it was actually created back in the ice age, back in the 15 million years ago or so. And we also have the San Joaquin. We have other areas. There's some areas in North China Plain that are being drawn down at an alarming rate. And they're typically all, on average, being drawn down at a rate between 3 and 7 times their recharge rate. So that means that you can just calculate out very, very, very quickly that we will be, I mean, if you knew the amount in terms of volume of these aquifers, that we're going to be out of those aquifers, especially the Ogallala, most likely in the next 15 to 20 years.
It's going to be very interesting the next few years.
Mm-hmm. It will be.
Yeah, it will be. We have this climate change tipping point predicted for 3 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Although some people had predicted 2010, and now we're at 2017, and God, I hope we can push it out further because I don't see much happening in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see it. How do you feel?
Well, of course, the reason I'm even talking to you right now, or that I've
written
the book, yes, I'm very optimistic. Otherwise, I'd probably crawl up in my own little sustainable fragment of the world and do everything that I know is right. And, I feel sorry for everybody else. But, the thing is about sustainability is that we all are in it together. And I don't know that not only is there a disconnect between, what we don't know about our unsustainable habits and then how it's related to the animal agriculture and our food choices, but we also don't really have a good feel that we have to all go on this ship together. Most of the people in the world and most organizations and policymakers are on this very large ship that are trying to get this sustainability, but they're going in a different direction because food choice isn't properly positioned. So I'm circling this back around to what we started out with by saying that we all have to do the right thing together or none of us will make it. And the timelines now are very, very clear, and I think the reason you're hearing that it's been pushed out a little bit is because those researchers are being a little bit more optimistic that we can still change it around. But if you look at all of them collectively, it's the tipping points in a number of areas are already gone. We're already past them. For instance, the 2,000 to 40,000 species that are going extinct each year, the tipping point's mm-hmm. obviously over for them.
Mm-hmm.
The tipping point for most of the fish in our oceans is over. I'm talking about our lifetime and future generations from now that we can somewhat see in the distance. As you said, I mean, if you apply anything at all about, the Gaia theory or something, we're remote to that, is that, sure, there'll be other species inhabiting the Earth, but it may not be humans.
Okay, we just have a few minutes, and I have one last quick question. And you traveled a lot around to collect information for this book, and I imagine you visited some farms. Did you talk to meat producers or animal product producers and share with them your thoughts on how you thought we need to eat more plants and less of what they were producing?
Oh, I do. Well, let's quickly look at a couple things you just said. I have visited maybe 300, 400 farms all over the world, especially the ones recently that have been promoted as the most sustainable, using that word again. So I, of course, would hop on a flight and go to see why they're the most sustainable, and they're not. And so not only did I record the reasons that they're not sustainable, because they all involve a higher level of inefficiency than if they just changed it entirely over to plant-based systems. But the second thing is that I will always talk to them about it, but it's on the exit, because otherwise I would be probably dismissed from their farm earlier, because
mm-hmm.
they're all under the belief that they're doing something sustainable. The ones, if you really talk to the grass-fed operators, they'll tell you that factory farms are still going to be needed. And that's a whole other topic.
Mm-hmm.
But they all feel that animal agriculture will be sustainable. They just, when you really nail them down and talk about the numbers, they'll tell you that parts or portions of their animal agriculture are not sustainable. But as a whole, we have to find ways to make sure that they just move their operations over certainly a much higher level of sustainability by transferring all their animal-based agriculture into plant-based. And that includes in developing countries. It's a very large topic, and that we don't have enough time to cover now. But, isn't that a shame that, most of their land has been eroded and destroyed because of their pastoral methods with cattle. And we just need to kind of do this globally, and we'd solve a lot of problems.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Richard Openlander, for writing this book. And I wish I could do some kind of Vulcan mind meld where everybody gets this information instantly, but we have a lot of work to do.
We do. I just thank you very much for the opportunity, Karen, and for all you're doing. And let's keep moving things forward and with a smile on our face. And the most important thing is to keep inspiring others to become aware.
That's right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we've come to the end of the program, and I just want to wish you a very good week and a delicious one. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and we'll be back next week. Bye.